Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been almost a month since terrifying natural gas explosions in northern Massachusetts leveled homes, injured dozens, and killed one young man. And across New England, the disaster reinforced fears about the safety of this energy source, including here in New Hampshire, where it increased debate over a proposed pipeline called the Granite Bridge. Still, millions of us rely on natural gas to heat our homes, cook, and generate electricity. And because of that, many efforts have been made to improve safety and expand regional access to it. Today in The Exchange, the future of natural gas in New England. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Steve Leahy, Vice President of Policy for the Northeast Gas Association. And Steve, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Also with us, Melissa Burchard. She's Staff Attorney for the Conservation Law Foundation. And Melissa, thank you for taking time out.
Thanks so much for having me.
And joining us from Boston, Bruce Gellerman, Senior Correspondent covering science, business, technology, and the environment for WBUR. And Bruce, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Lauren. Hello to Melissa and Steve.
So all of you, after the tragedy in Massachusetts, as I'm sure you know, the question up here in the Granite State was, could it happen here? And Steve, to you first, how would you answer that question?
Well, I first want to recognize it was a terrible event, but I would just underscore it's a very rare event. You can check the federal data tracking what is called incidents on the natural gas system, and the number is very low. And the industry obviously wants to make it zero all the time because any incident can have serious repercussions. This one is very unusual in that the extent of it is really unusual. And so it's over three towns. It's about 8,500 customers were affected. So there were about 80 homes, I think, impacted by fires. But because it's a pressurized system, you have to shut down basically the whole area that was affected. So even some homes that might not have been affected, they were shut off for safety reasons. But I think that, as we can get into it in the discussion, the safety record is strong for the gas industry in the region and nationally. The industry takes it very seriously. It's very well regulated at the state and federal level. There's a lot of training, and that's part of what I'm with the trade association that represents gas utilities and pipeline companies. And that's one of our main tasks is to actually oversee the training of workers on the natural gas system, because any worker on the gas system has to be trained to a specific task. So every specific task, they have to be trained and qualified, and then they have to be requalified in a few years. So we think it's safe, but this was a very disturbing incident.
Well, sure, and a lot more people could have died, right, Steve? I mean, it just so happened that it was a time of day when people weren't really at home, and so it could have been a lot worse.
Yes, it could have been. I don't know the NTSB is the National Transportation Safety Board, is the actual agency that oversees any incidents. So the gas system, by the NTSB standard, is actually a transportation system. So
because the gas is
transported. They're looking right. So they're looking into that. We're very relieved it wasn't more impact in terms of fatality. There were injuries, and it's very serious. It's the most serious incident in New England. In my memory, and I've been with the industry 20 years now.
Wow. Okay, and there's lots to unpack there in terms of worker training and how the gas is transported and so forth, as you said, Steve. But Melissa, when this happened about a month ago, a lot of people here in New Hampshire, as I said, were saying, wow, could this happen here? And what do you think about that question?
Absolutely. It could happen here. Does it happen every day? No. But when you're piping an explosive fossil fuel into people's kitchens, into people's basements. Families and businesses, you know, should realize there's an inherent risk in that natural gas is explosive. Do we have oversight measures? Yes, we do. But we've seen Liberty Gas make errors. We've seen human errors with some regularity. And we can't eliminate those with a fossil fuel like this.
So to answer the question, could it happen here? You would say, yeah, it could.
Absolutely. We have to be realistic about that. I'm glad that folks are on the case and trying to improve oversight, improve regulation. But the reality is there are cleaner, safer alternatives right now. And if I was a family in Massachusetts, I would be thinking about those cleaner, safer alternatives.
Well, we'll definitely talk about that as well, how this fits into the whole bigger energy picture that we talk a lot about on this program. But Bruce, to without revisiting too much of what happened in Massachusetts, but we are trying to say, here's what happened and here's what we have here in New Hampshire. What kind of investigations have been underway, Bruce, as to the exact cause of what triggered those explosions?
Well, as Steve said, the NTSB is the federal authority that oversees these investigations. They're in there. They were there actually that night and had a press conference the next morning, and they took control of the situation. But, of course, the gas company, Columbia, is investigating. They're taking a second position to NTSB. But so they're looking at everything. There were 9 projects in the area that were going on to replace old pipes. Some of these pipes, Laura, go back over a century ago. I mean, they're cast iron, they're wrought iron. There's so much old pipe here. So they were working on that. And it's seemingly, what we can kind of put together here is that there are these vaults that are in the ground, and they regulate the pressure that comes off of a main pipe into the service areas. And they step it down and they make sure the pressure is all copacetic. But it seems that one of these, and I've kind of pinpointed the one, was either tampered with or mistakenly maintained, being worked on, and that's where the problem originated.
These are the regulators that I've read about, Bruce, not people regulators, but like sort of right. Systemic regulators?
Yeah, they're buried in the ground, and they're very simple devices, actually. I was looking at them, and they basically step down the pressure, taking it from like 6 or 8 pounds to like 1 or half a pound, or even a quarter pound to the service, to the houses. So you had, all of these miles, 48, 49 miles of main service going to these 3 towns, and then they branch off like, capillaries in a body. But between those mains is a vault in the ground where they bury these kind of regulators and they step down the pressure.
All right. Well, again, lots to look at. And I want to remind our listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So let's just figure out how this whole system works, and then we can look more broadly at how widespread the use of natural gas is here in New England and some of the alternatives that Melissa talked about. And Steve, just a real primer first. How does natural gas get from the plant to my house? Is it always underground? Is it ever above ground? How does that work?
It's basically an underground system. So as Bruce mentioned, and the essence of the system is pressure. So the gas is delivered by what's called a transmission company, interstate pipeline company, and that's at a higher pressure. And that can come from Western Canada. It can come from Pennsylvania. It can come from, we even get gas from offshore Nova Scotia. Comes down through an interstate pipeline system. Generally, they hand it off to the local distribution company. So in New Hampshire, you have 2 gas utilities, Liberty and Unitil. So at a city gate, they hand it off to the gas utility, and then they step the pressure down further. And then they have their own, called the distribution system, and so they would potentially have a distribution main down a main street. And then, as Bruce mentioned, there's like capillaries. Then there are lines off that could go to different facilities like a hospital or a city block or to individual homes. And as they hand it off, the gas, to those end-use customers, could be a residence or a business, the pressure is stepped down again. And it's controlled as Bruce mentioned, by things like regulators, their pressure sensors. So the gas that comes into your house to feed into your appliances could feed into a furnace or water heater. That's stepped down again because each appliance is set to a specific pressure. So it's a question of stepping down the pressure and controlling the pressure. And so the gas companies, gas utilities, monitor the pressure at all times.
Well, and I can see, you know, I can see why it's underground, because you wouldn't want 8 gazillion pipes traversing your city sidewalks. But I'm wondering how hard it makes it, Steve, to see how good the pipes are, see if there's leaks. Bruce mentioned that they're pretty old. So I'm just wondering if that makes it more difficult to keep an eye on things.
Well, there are technologies now, like robots, that basically get inserted into an interstate pipeline system or a distribution system. It's called pigging line, and they're required on a regular basis to pig the line, which basically has an infrared camera that can look at, because one of the potential causes of a leak or an incident is internal corrosion, external corrosion. So you're able to monitor it that way. I mean, another big thing the industry does is safety awareness, because the major cause of incidents on the gas system is being struck inadvertently by a third party,
say
this construction crew or a snowplow or somebody's working on the water line or something. And so you want to make sure the line is marked, but you want to make sure any contractor or other utility that's going to do work underground is aware of where the gas system is, so it's not struck. But that third-party damage is an issue. And then very quickly, I don't mean to take too much time on, Bruce mentioned older systems. We do have older systems in New England.
We're an older region.
We know the part of the country. So just like infrastructure in other systems, I would know New Hampshire is in very good shape because it's a newer system. And so the cast iron, bare steel that Bruce mentioned that's considered potentially more leak prone is less than 5% of the system, distribution system in New Hampshire.
So you're saying our pipes are actually better.
Your pipes are better, newer. And then in Massachusetts, a few years ago, it was like 30% of the system was considered leak prone. Now it's down to 20%. And you can see the same in the other states, because there's been an effort, especially in the last 5 years, and also with the support and the work of the environmental community to address replacing older pipes. So for the gas industry, traditionally, and also, it's been a safety issue, replacing older pipes with newer systems is a more secure system. And then for the environmental community, is concerned about leaks of emissions of methane. So you're getting, you're
methane
enhancing
makes a big problem.
Integrity, the safety of the system, but you're also reducing the risk of leaks.
Well, and to the environmental point, we got an email here, actually a Facebook comment from Frank, who says, when will we as a state stop using natural gas, fossil fuels, and make the switch completely to solar, hydro, and wind power? Frank says, this way we can lead the way for our nation in completely eradicating pollution. Our children deserve to be left a clean, healthy earth before we go. And Frank, thank you so much for the comment, because this does get into the bigger issue that's been talked about, gosh, for at least the past decade, I think. Melissa, I'll turn to you first, that New England overall is too reliant on natural gas. Just remind us how reliant we are and how that's changed just in the past, 5-10 years.
That's right. We increasingly have clean alternatives, and yet we still rely a great deal on natural gas. Now, there's natural gas for power plants, and then there's natural gas to heat our homes and to cook our food with. The natural gas that we use in power plants has increased a great deal in recent years.
It's almost 50% now, right?
Yes, and folks all over the region are sounding the alarm, saying it is not good to rely too much on one fuel source, particularly a fossil fuel that has potentially volatile prices. In any event, it's not reliable to have that much of your electricity coming from a fossil fuel like gas. In addition, we have what's heating our homes, what we're cooking with on our stoves, what's heating our water in our house. And here in New Hampshire, we're a little bit different from Massachusetts. We don't have as big a gas distribution system for that purpose. in New Hampshire. And so actually we have a choice now. We have a choice to say, you know, we hear the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the body of world experts on climate change, saying this is a red alert. We need to get off fossil fuels. We have the chance here in New Hampshire to say, you know, why build that out more? Why sink more and more money into a fossil fuel that we're too reliant on already and that we don't actually need anymore? You know, there might have been a time in the past when we didn't have those clean, safe alternatives that we do have now. But I don't need natural gas in my home now, and neither do other folks in New Hampshire, because we have those electric alternatives like heat pumps. I have a heat pump in my home. It's clean, it's quiet, and it's safe.
Is that geothermal?
It is not. It's an air source heat pump, although, okay, you know, I have some friends who do have geothermal heat pumps, but mine just sucks the heat right out of the air. It's very simple. It's just like the way your refrigerator works, actually. It's the same kind of technology. So we've got those heat pumps to heat our homes. We also have heat pump technologies to heat our water. And we have electric stoves that are safer. I have an induction plate in my home that heats things just as well as natural gas. Heats up quickly, cools off quickly. It's very safe. I don't have to have those natural gas pipelines coming to my home. And that means I'm cleaner, I'm safer, and I'm lower cost. We don't have to have that huge investment in pipelines.
Although the electricity on your stove, that electricity might be generated by a natural gas plant right here in New England, because so many of our electric plants are generated by natural
gas.
Here
in New England, we are over-reliant on natural gas, as we just discussed. So absolutely, you're correct. But we have alternatives that are better than natural gas, and we are increasingly moving towards clean, renewable energy like solar power, like wind power. We have those solutions right now.
Well, and Bruce, what has the independent system operator? Now, that sounds like a fussy title, but these are important folks. These are the people who basically oversee the whole electrical power system for the six New England states. So what has ISO New England, as it's called, said about the region's increasing reliance on natural gas?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I just opened a handy app that I get from the ISO. It's called ISO To Go, and it breaks down the fuel mix of the area in a snapshot. Right now, Laura, how much percent do you think of the region, this is the New England region, how much percent of the New England region's electricity is generated by electricity? Take a guess.
By natural gas, you mean?
Yeah.
I think it's like 50 to 60% or at least 50%.
Right now, it's 72%.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. That's up since the last time I looked at it.
It's high. That's high. It's usually 50, 60%. And, you know, about a fifth of New Hampshire's electricity is generated by natural gas, which is actually low in terms of compared, certainly for Massachusetts. We get about 60% of ours overall. So, you know, you get half of, you know, 20% from, you know, your Seabrook nuclear power plant. You get a lot from biomass, a lot from hydro. So you've got a kind of a more equal balanced kind of mix in terms of the energy sources.
So ISO has said, right, Bruce, heading into a break, so keep it short, please. But ISO has said the region as a whole is a little too reliant on natural gas.
Absolutely. And ISO New England is a big advocate for bringing in more natural gas. They want more capacity, more pipeline to service the area, especially in southern New Hampshire.
Okay, so they've said you rely too much, New England, on natural gas, but by the way, we need more pipelines. So a little bit of a mixed message there maybe, but we'll talk after a short break, and we'll take a lot more of your comments. Emails are coming in. You can send yours, exchange@nhpr.org. Frank, thank you for that Facebook comment. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange. And of course, you can give us a call. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. More in a moment on the future of natural gas in New England. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A on NHPR. And as a fan of the show, I wanted to let you know that we are coming to New Hampshire and you can be part of the conversation. Join me for an evening of fantastic discussion about issues that matter to you and to the Granite State. Join us on Thursday, October 18th at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord. You can get your tickets right now at ccanh.com. See you then.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how safe is our natural gas infrastructure? It's what many Granite Staters are asking after the explosions in northern Massachusetts. We're finding out about efforts companies are making, the rules and regs from the state and local communities, and what supporters and opponents of this energy source hope will happen next. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. You can always send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests for the hour. Melissa Burchard is with us. She's staff attorney for the Conservation Law Foundation. Steve Leahy is here, vice president of policy for the Northeast Gas Association. And joining us from Boston, Bruce Gellerman, senior correspondent covering science and the environment for WBUR. One more time, that number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. And Bruce, just to clarify, before the break, we were talking about how the independent system operator has said New Hampshire and New England rely too much on natural gas, but the region also wants to expand the availability of natural gas. So just help us figure that out there, because it sounded like conflicting messages, but maybe not.
Well, you know, the ISO has got two responsibilities, major responsibilities. One is to make sure the system throughout New England, the electrical distribution system, is reliable, right? From cyber attacks, from going down, from brownouts, you name it. They want the system up and running 100% of the time. The other thing is they manage the market for the cost of gas and regulate the buying and selling of capacity and the utilities buying and selling of their resources, of their generation capacity. So what they've observed is their first requirement is to keep it up and running, and they've said, well, we're getting increasingly more reliant on cheap natural gas, especially fractured gas from the Marcellus region in West Virginia, Virginia, Pennsylvania. We want to bring it up. It's there. It's plentiful. It's cheap. We need it. People want it. Let's give it to them. And, of course, a lot of people don't want it. They don't want the pipelines. They don't want the safety issues and so on. So that's the dichotomy. That's the contradiction there.
Well, so, Melissa, again, a lot of people have said, including ISO, that the shift to natural gas has benefited New England. We've got clean burning, relatively clean burning for a fossil fuel. This is what the natural gas folks say, contributing to a decline in air emissions here in New England, helping keep prices stable. So there's been some benefits, ISO has said, to having lots of natural gas here in New England. Better than coal, people often say. And I just wonder what role you see, Melissa, for natural gas in this region.
I think Bruce's point that natural gas is cheap right now at this moment in history is an important one. We've seen a transition away from coal in the markets because we do have other factors, including the inexpensive cost of natural gas, driving a transition. And so the whole country is getting cleaner as it comes off of coal. But you have to ask yourself, you're moving from one fossil fuel to another, and we can't get to where we need to be for our climate goals, and that means for health and safety, frankly. We can't get to where we need to be for our long-term health and safety if we just transition from one fossil fuel to another fossil fuel. And what we're seeing at the same time, we are seeing dramatically decreasing wind prices. Offshore wind is no longer on the horizon, it is here. And offshore wind prices are stunning regulators and states and environmentalists. You know, these prices are lower than we had anticipated. Wind prices are going down, solar prices are going down. We have clean electric alternatives. We don't need to keep investing in more and more fossil fuels, especially when you look at the fact that we don't, we don't want to put millions and potentially billions of dollars into pipes in the ground that we won't need.
To encourage something that you feel is not needed. I want to get Stephen on this, too. But a quick question for you, Melissa. Solar and wind often described as intermittent. And so some people say, hey, let's keep this natural gas infrastructure in place so that when solar and wind are not available, we can still turn the lights on and still charge our phones.
Right, right.
So do we need some level of natural gas there just for safety's sake, for backup's sake?
Right. Well, I'm not saying rip out the pipes tomorrow. I'm saying don't invest in anymore. It's not a smart investment, and ratepayers are going to pay the cost. Families and businesses are going to pay the cost. But in addition, technologically speaking, solar and wind are great in that they are very compatible. Wind is strong at night. Solar is strong in the daytime. And so although they're intermittent, they tend to balance each other out. We've also got hydro that adds to that balancing. And in addition, we have storage. Energy storage, those prices are dropping.
As the batteries improve.
Dramatically. Well, the technology is getting better, but it's also getting cheaper. It's getting more accessible. And it's being used across the country in exchange for what would be actually a more expensive natural gas investment.
Well, and Steve, I want to go to you and then to our listeners. You know, for years and years, people have come into this studio and said natural gas is a bridge fuel to these cleaner alternatives. But we still seem to be on the bridge with, you know, as Bruce told us, 50, 60, 70% reliance. So I just wonder what you think about this idea of natural gas as a bridge fuel, really? Or are we just going to rely on it for the long-term future?
Well, it's sort of fallen out of fashion to use the term bridge fuel. But I think it
absolutely
is a bridge fuel. No, and I think it's good. But and the bridge.
We've been on the bridge for a long time.
And I think we're going to be on the bridge for a long time. You know, I would, for the ISO, in their recent, I don't know what report it was, reliability report, looks at the role of natural gas actually increasing in New England over the next decade. And a key reason for that is we have other options retiring. We're going to have, we've had a nuclear plant retire in Maine, one retire in Vermont, one retire in Rowe, Mass. Next year, Pilgrim's going to retire in Mass, another nuclear. They're retiring. You get coal plants retiring. You get oil plants retiring. And I absolutely agree with Melissa about the role of offshore wind is coming. Potentially, there's going to be another line to Quebec for hydropower coming into New England. And all the states in New England, basically from a policy perspective, regulatory perspective, they all want to increase, go to clean energy. But it's still years away. And so, like for even this summer in New England, there was a new gas power plant that opened in Salem, Mass., replaced a coal and oil unit, so that's a good thing. There was one that opened another 800 megawatts in Connecticut, so that's 1,500 megawatts this year. There's another gas plant opening next year in Bridgeport, Connecticut. So it's really filling the gap. And I think Bruce mentioned, you know, the role of ISO.
And again, that's
I would say they're not really advocating for natural gas, but they're just being realistic about this is the system. This is what we have today. This is what we have retiring. You do have renewables coming in, but they're not here yet. You know, even the offshore wind was at 2022, 24, 25. And the role of energy storage is very exciting, and Massachusetts is doing a lot in energy storage, but it isn't quite there yet. It's still in, I want to call it a prototype, but it's not significant. So I think really so the way ISO would see it, okay, we need natural gas as a base load to run most of the time, like 70% right now. And then when the wind and solar isn't producing power, you need fast starting gas to come on or something else.
Steve, been gas. And it's good to hear you and Melissa actually agreeing that this is a bridge fuel, although as you point out, she doesn't agree with that. I'll get to you in a second. Just the idea that, you know, we've been on this bridge for a while, and I'm kind of stunned to hear you say that we could be on this bridge for another decade or even more. What about the idea that if you are focused on increasing natural gas capacity, you won't put the time and energy and investment into these non-fossil fuel types of energy?
You know, I hear that argument, and there may be some truth to it. But the reality is in New England, we've added for the – and I think Melissa had mentioned there's like two markets. There's a power market, which uses a lot of gas. And then there's the home heating, the gas utility market. And we've added like over 200,000 heating customers in New England, in the six states, in the last decade. You know, the first part of that period, there was a big – price spread between natural gas and oil in the favor of natural gas. So people want gas. Gas is convenient, and we would say it is a safe and reliable fuel. But even you look in New Hampshire, I'm looking at the census data, the most recent census data for New Hampshire. Natural gas is 21% of the home heating market. Heating oil is 43%, and propane is 17%. So that's about, and electricity is 9%. So it's just the reality of recognizing that the system is heavily weighted to fossil fuels, and I realize that people want to change. away from that, and regulatory policy wants to change away from that, but it's going to take a little while.
And Melissa, I'm sorry, I misinterpreted your position. So you don't agree with the characterization of natural gas as a bridge fuel?
So what we just heard from Stephen is that, you know, he thinks clean renewable energy isn't here yet. And I would contest that strongly. It's here. And if you want to talk about natural gas, natural gas pipelines don't go in the ground overnight. They take time, too. And you can get an offshore wind plant or, you know, a solar farm up as quick or quicker than any kind of fossil fuel infrastructure. So if you compare the two apples to apples, clean energy is here. It's cheaper. It's better. And it's a greater investment for our future and for our kids. And in terms of, you know, ISO's view that we need more of this, I understand they want to get in on the action on this fracked gas. But the reality is we have resources right here in New England that are cleaner and that we can build faster.
If you can get through the regulatory process, because there's been a lot of community opposition to wind farms in certain areas and so forth.
Here in New Hampshire, we do have a lot of community opposition to wind farms. Siting is a big issue.
Yeah.
Offshore wind seems to be much more popular right now, and you can build it to scale in a dramatic way. One other thing I would point out in terms of ISO's analysis is, you know, I think they're having a little trouble envisioning these cheap prices that we're now getting to. I also think that each year they underestimate resources that we already have, including energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is something we aren't investing in enough here in New Hampshire, but it is absolutely the cheapest resource. And you don't have to build a pipeline. You don't have to build a wind power plant. You don't have to build anything. You just have to take advantage of energy efficiency in our businesses and homes, and it makes a huge difference. You want to look at what's actually keeping prices down in New England. Energy efficiency is doing a lot of that work.
Well, both of you want to bring Bruce Gellerman back in again at BUR. And then lots of people want to jump into our conversation. Mm-hmm. This is great. So, Bruce, go ahead, and then we'll go to our listeners.
Well, I wanted to note that in 2016, for the first time, New Hampshire obtained more of its net electricity generated from wind than coal. And that's continuing. That trend has been going on now for the last 2 years. I would also say in terms of this bridge fuel, it may be a bridge too far. That is, once you build these $1 billion of intrastate or interstate pipelines, you're going to want to use them. And these pipelines can last for 100 years. If the price of natural gas was to go up, and that's not unlikely, and the gas companies decided they wanted to use other resources, you might have these stranded assets. That is, people, users had to pay for them, but they're not being utilized to the capacity.
And so remember, if you build it, you need to use it.
And if you build it, they may come, and they may not come in the future. So you've got this dichotomy there, too. And then in terms of storage is taking off. It's going to start being mandated here in Massachusetts. That is, the renewable energy gets stored in various types of chemistries and batteries. I mean, you've got hydro can store energy. In fact, the largest battery in the United States is right in Massachusetts. And it's basically hydro battery. They pump water down when it's cheap, and they pump it up when it's not, and they use it when it falls down and it turns turbines, and voila, you've got two Seabrooks right there.
All right. Let's go to our listeners, all of you. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Give us your questions and comments by email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And George is calling from Hillsborough. Hi, George. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a licensed professional engineer. I have 40 years in the energy industry, all forms of energy, renewable as well as the traditional fossil fuels. So there's a couple of salient points I think that both contributors need to be mindful about, and I'll be brief. Number one is this issue of efficiency. Natural gas is essentially methane, CH4. It's a molecule with the smallest amount of carbon. So therefore, per pound of methane burned to produce BTUs of energy, it's almost categorically a clean fuel. It's so much cleaner than the counterparts of oil and coal and in New Hampshire wood. It's just off the chart cleaner, number one. Number two, for every BTU of methane is pumped from the ground, about 90% ends up at the burner tip. There's about a 10% loss to compress the natural gas and to bring it to the distribution system to your home to heat your to heat your home.
So you're saying it's pretty good fuel, electric, George?
I'm sorry?
You're saying it's a pretty good fuel?
I'm saying that it's not to be discarded as a fuel that should be looked at disparagingly, because it's so much cleaner than the competition. And with offshore wind and hydro and solar, you're moving energy through wires. There's I squared R losses. There's hysteresis losses. With a power plant, for every unit of energy you produce at the generator, about 28% ends up at your receptacle at your house. There's about 70% loss through heat because the conductors are not perfect. They have resistance. So we have to look at the whole picture, look at it from a global perspective, the cost associated with investments in offshore and solar. But the biggest argument that we have to keep in mind is the need to become more efficient. My consulting practice is in Connecticut. I'm up here in my summer house in New Hampshire. I am shocked at how far behind New Hampshire is with taking energy efficiency in a serious note. Washington is pushing us in the wrong direction. We have to get serious about using less energy, regardless of where it comes from.
Well, George, thank you so much. And you definitely know your stuff. And it's great to get your perspective. And Steve, you first, and then Melissa.
Yeah, I appreciate George's comments. And I would pick up on the last comment about efficiency. And there's a group called ACEEE that does an annual summary of what each state is doing in terms of electric and gas efficiency. Their annual report came out last week. Massachusetts is number one in the nation. But I just want to point out that the New England and Northeast states are very active in electric and gas efficiency. And so on the gas efficiency side, we represent nine Northeast states. That's 15% of all U.S. gas consumption. But we invest, these same nine states, 40% of all the gas efficiency dollars. So we really
So you're trying to use
over-invest.
Every last BTU, as you pointed out.
So we really do invest, because I agree. And you can see that in homes, the average use of natural gas per residential customer has gone down a lot in the last 30 years, because homes are built better, and the impact of efficiency programs. And I will just quickly, on the methane issue, we're also seeing reductions in methane in gas distribution.
Because methane, as we know, is an even worse greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
If it's released. So part of replacing these systems is to reduce that. Massachusetts and New York DEC, DEP show it's down close to 70%.
Well, and Melissa, what do you pull out of George's call? He had a lot of things to say about the efficiency of natural gas.
I think his focus on efficiency is great, and I particularly appreciated his emphasis on energy efficiency in New Hampshire. And, you know, the ACEEE, this organization that is kind of the premier energy efficiency organization, did come out with its rankings of the states on Friday, I believe it was, which was National Energy Efficiency Day. And they ranked New Hampshire last in the entire region. New Hampshire is not doing well on energy efficiency right now. The reason is we don't have the utilities all on board with making energy efficiency happen, and that includes the natural gas utilities. We don't have legislators who hear from the utilities saying, let's do this, let's make this happen, let's not be last anymore, because energy efficiency is cheaper and it just makes sense for families and businesses.
One less plant you have to build.
That's absolutely right. And you know what else? It makes us safer and healthier in our homes, because we have energy efficient technology in our home, but then also for the region.
All right. We will take a lot more of your calls after a short break. George, thank you for that one. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, a candidate forum with the first congressional district nominees from the Democratic and Republican parties, Democrat Chris Pappas and Republican Eddie Edwards. Now, you can send us your questions for the candidates before the show to exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9. This hour on The Exchange, we're looking at natural gas, how it fits into the wider energy picture here in New England, and what lessons we've learned so far from the explosions about a month ago in Massachusetts. You can join us with your comments, questions, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Melissa, Bruce, and Steve, let's go right back to our listeners. And Leela's on the line from Dover. Leela, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, this is Ariel from Heartland.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ariel. Go ahead. We put up the wrong call, but you're welcome to join us, Ariel. Go ahead.
Thank you. I would like to echo, Laura, your mention of methane being a stronger greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. This is something that's rarely really identified specifically. In 2013, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change pointed out that in the 100-year time frame, methane, which is natural gas, 85-95%, is 34 times more potent a greenhouse gas, warming gas, than
34 times, wow, yep.
34, but in the 20-year time frame, which is a critical time frame because we really have to turn the climate change disruption around in the near term, in the 20-year time frame, it's between 86 and 100 times. And so when you put a gas system in which depreciates over an average of 50 years or may last 100 years, cause stranded assets, which encourages people to continue using it, you're investing in something that really delays the transition to renewable energy, as Melissa reported, is here, if we had the political will to embrace it. So
well, Ariel,
when people talk about natural gas being cleaner, it's true. It's cleaner when it's burned by around 30%. But the methane leaks, which even if it leaks in small degrees, which is really, really, really difficult to control, it cancels out the benefits.
So I see what you're really saying, Ariel. Let's turn to Bruce Gellerman on this. Yeah, because Bruce, I know you sort of look at the bigger picture. And what about that? I've heard what Ariel says, that, you know, that natural gas, as our guests have said, burns cleanly, more cleanly certainly than coal. But when the leaks happen, it's bad in terms of climate change.
Yeah, and as Ariel said, you know, methane is a very potent, pernicious greenhouse gas. It's I think something like 80 times. There's lots of studies on this, but it's about 80 times the rule of thumb that I use in terms of its climate warming impact of carbon dioxide over, you know, 20 years. There have been studies that show that methane leaks greater than 3% would result in no climate benefits for retiring coal-fired plants. That is, so you might as well have coal if you're going to have these amount of leaks. Now, the question is, how many leaks do we have? And that's up to debate. Some people say 1.4%, some say 2.4%. But there's no question that the containing the gas is a very, very important part of maintaining the safety of the planet. So, you know, you've got to worry about this pernicious gas and maintain the integrity of the pipeline from the well drilling in the Marcellus all the way to your house.
Well, and here's an email from Patricia who sort of talks about this, you know, cost benefit and the leaks and gets to the aging pipeline issue. Patricia says Liberty isn't scheduled to replace the last of its cast iron and bare steel pipe until 2034. Meanwhile, she says those leaky pipes accelerate climate change and cost ratepayers $2.4 million last year. Massachusetts, Patricia says, passed legislation this year requiring utilities and the Department of Public Utilities to give an accounting of lost gas and to use innovative approaches to repairing and replacing their old distribution lines. Can someone on the panel, Patricia asks, describe what those innovative approaches involve and whether the New Hampshire gas utilities would be willing to do something similar in New Hampshire? So, Bruce, I'll give you the first part of that. What innovative approaches has Massachusetts taken to prevent some of these leaks that that Ariel talks about?
Well, we have laws that we passed about 3 or 4 years ago that says that they have to categorize the leaks from 1 to 3, being 1 being the worst. So that's new. And there are innovative ways of replacing pipelines. Basically, they don't want to dig up a street or somebody's front yard.
It's very disruptive.
It's very expensive. And so what they would do is they have different ways of kind of tunneling under and following the old pipe, either inserting new plastic pipe through the old pipe or kind of drilling away the old pipe and then following it back with the new plastic PVC pipe. So those are the ways they're doing it. But yeah, you know, I mean, here in Massachusetts, the National Grid, which is the largest provider of natural gas in the Commonwealth here, has a 20-year plan all flat out. I mean, they've got contracts running to 20 years. I'm not sure if they're contract signed, but that's what they say. It's going to take us 20 years to replace the 21,000 miles of pipeline here, and that doesn't even include the service from the main to the houses. So they got a lot of work.
So, Steve, what about the second part of her question, whether the New Hampshire gas utilities would be willing to do something similar in New Hampshire?
I mentioned at the start a key metric of the integrity of the system is the constituents of the pipe. And as I mentioned, for New Hampshire, it's less than 5% of both utilities' system is considered leak prone. And then Liberty Utilities, I think just last week or the week before, announced, I guess, another innovative project. You're hearing a lot more about something called renewable natural gas. So they announced.
Oh, what is that?
Well, so the three leading sources of methane in the U.S. Number one is agriculture and cows, manure. Number two is natural gas systems. And number three is landfills. So Liberty announced a plan. There's a landfill in Bethlehem, apparently. So they're going to, so there's methane gas there from decomposition and other materials there. So they're going to, planning to capture that landfill gas and purify it, make sure it's an appropriate condition to go into their distribution system. So in their press release, they said 6% of their gas supply in coming years will come from this landfill. So they're capturing methane, which rather than let it escape or just ferment there, they'll capture it and reuse it. So it's a more efficient use. It's reducing environmental impact. It's obviating the need for that supply source from somewhere else. They're getting it from an in region. So, and you see that in Vermont is doing something, and even Con Edison, which is the big gas utility in Manhattan, announced they're going to try to incorporate more renewable natural gas, which could be.
So from these landfills and so
basically
forth.
From landfills and from farms.
So here's a big question for you, Steve, and then Melissa, I've got another one for you. But Bruce Gellerman said something interesting. You know, it's going to take 20 years to sort of upgrade this giant pipeline infrastructure here in New England. And, you know, one could ask, well, if we really all want to move towards renewables that don't leak and that aren't fossil fuels, why bother to create new infrastructure and upgrade this infrastructure? Why not just start doing it now?
Well, I'd say, I guess your question is really more about upgrading. I'll take that instead of investing in new, which we could leave for another question.
I see the point because you don't want leaky pipes and you don't want explosions. But what about
in Massachusetts, there's 1.6 million gas customers. So that's a lot of gas customers. In the region, it's over 2.5 million. It's a very convenient, people like natural gas. And we've seen that by the number of conversions to natural gas. And it's now the leading home heating fuel in New England. Forever, it's been heating oil, but now it's natural gas. So repairing the pipes, I think, as we mentioned at the start, there's a safety issue. There's a safety reason. Let's do it. And number two, reducing potential methane emissions.
What about new infrastructure? Because there are proposals on the table around the region to invest in new infrastructure. Bruce told us earlier that the independent system operator wants to increase capacity because the region is so reliant. Groups like Melissa's would say, don't bother.
Right. Well, even the New England governors a few years ago put out a statement. They were encouraging more pipeline capacity to serve because they're concerned about a reliability issue with so many gas power plants. And then we can get into the whole winter argument, which we don't have time to get into. But they recently came out with another press. They met in Vermont last month, and they're looking at maybe LNG or compressed natural gas as backup.
LNG is liquefied natural gas.
I would just quickly mention that, you know, the concern over stranded investments, the way gas pipelines or gas capacity get built is they have to be financed and they have to have contracts. So the main contracting parties have been the gas utilities because they have to prove to the Public Utility Commission that they have adequate supply to meet, you know, what is your customer base going to be in 5 years? How, you know, what's your expected demand going to be and how are you going to meet that? Well, we need to increase here or there. So they would sign long-term contracts for that. And then on the power generator side, it's a more complicated issue. But I think the pipelines and capacity is not going to get built unless people sign contracts for it. So I don't think – I know there were a couple of major proposals a couple of years ago, and the reason they didn't go forward is the power generators did not sign contracts for that. And so you're not going to have the stranded investment because the investment that is being built is to meet actual customer commitments.
So, Melissa, here's the question for you. And I've heard your, you know, heard what all of you guys are saying, and I've heard your message that, you know, let's do this now. But doing it now, meaning going to wind and solar and so forth, in New Hampshire, anyway, has been difficult. Hydro projects have been rejected. Wind power projects have been rejected. Energy companies complain that the process is really long and they invest all this time and energy into making it happen, and then it just gets shot down. You've got the local opposition. You've got the site evaluation committee. So some energy people that I've spoken to have said New Hampshire's got a reputation as a state of no. So, you know, we're sitting here saying, okay, wind, solar, great. Hydro, but it's tough in New Hampshire.
It is tough in New Hampshire. It's always so tough to be a regulated entity where you get paid for your costs from your customers and the families and businesses of the state. I guess I would go back to that.
I'm talking about approval, though.
Like, sure.
You know, you're talking a lot about wind, but wind has had a really bumpy road here in New Hampshire.
One of the things
solar's
we're
had some troubles in the legislature. Hydro,
absolutely.
Northern Pass, you know.
Yeah, yeah. There are strict regulatory processes for a reason, and ours aren't perfect in New Hampshire, but I would say that some clean technologies are really taking off. Rooftop solar is taking off. Energy efficiency needs to take off. We need to put an emphasis on that. We have more energy production here in New Hampshire than we need. So it's not that we need to become the region's energy powerhouse. We already produce more than we need. The region as a whole needs to get cleaner and cleaner. But going back to this question of efficiency, you know, heat pumps are more efficient than natural gas. So if you're really looking for efficiency, go for a heat pump. And you don't have to deal with the stranded costs. But the stranded costs that come from investing in massive pipelines and massive infrastructure, the reason they become stranded costs is because those gas companies are looking to the families and businesses to pay for their risk. So the big pipelines that the gas companies were advocating to build and get frack gas up to New England, they didn't want to take the risk to pay for the costs of those pipelines. They wanted to put that risk onto the backs of ratepayers. And the electric regulator said no. That's not okay. It's not going to happen. If the companies want to build pipelines, they can absorb the risk themselves. Well, the companies didn't. The money wasn't there. It didn't financially pencil out. So we've avoided that for now, and I would urge us to continue to avoid that. As for the distribution side of it, we've got Liberty Utilities here, and the reason they're going before their regulator is because they want to reach a whole new set of customers with their distribution services. They want to bring gas to a whole new set of customers. And in order to do that, they're asking regulators to charge their current existing customers
so they can build that infrastructure.
A whole lot of money on the speculation that they will be able to reach some new customers in the future.
I guess my question for you, though, Melissa, is from the environmental standpoint, you know, again, you'd like to see a cleaner energy, non-fossil fuel-based future. What are groups like yours doing in terms of making it easier for these projects to get approved? Because, again, it's been a tough road here in New Hampshire. People say they want it, but not in their backyard.
Right, right.
So what's your role in that process?
Each state in the region has a different role to play. And as I mentioned, New Hampshire is actually already a net exporter of energy. So we expect the other states to step up, and Conservation Law Foundation and others are working in states like Massachusetts and states like Rhode Island and states like Connecticut. And clean energy is coming to those states on a massive scale. In terms of New Hampshire, we have challenges too. Energy efficiency, I would put as our number one priority right now. We really need to make that happen because it's cheap. It helps us to avoid the regional grid costs. All the other states are already so far ahead of us on energy efficiency that our families and businesses are going to have to absorb much higher costs for that regional grid than we would if we were investing similarly in energy efficiency. Other states get to save money. We get to pay more. That's how it works. So I would put energy efficiency at the top of the list of things that we need to change in New Hampshire. After that, we've got to support this growing movement of rooftop solar. We've got to get real about making clean energy something that we put our, you know, money where our mouth is, basically.
Well, and Bruce, lastly to you, mm-hmm. in the Massachusetts legislature, in local and state politics, what's the future of natural gas looking like, again, given what happened about a month ago?
Oh, that's such a good question, Laura. I, You know, I spoke to the Lori Ehrlich, who was the legislator here who led the effort to plug pipelines, and she and I had a long conversation just last week about this very topic. And there's no pending legislation to regulate things further, but, you know, it's so driven by demand and the weather. Right. So only on a few days here in Massachusetts do we actually need such capacity when the rates start skyrocketing and the spot market for electricity and energy start soaring. It's only about 10 or 14 days a year on the worst years. So the question is whether you're going to, how do you regulate and maintain a system that only needs that kind of extreme capacity going forward. I would say, you know, up in New Hampshire, and Melissa was quite right, New Hampshire actually generates almost half the electricity that it generates goes to other states. So your problem is not generation capacity, and it probably is efficiency. That's the cheapest megawatt is the one you don't buy. But we started off, and I'll end very quickly here, though, that remember, it's low probability that you'll have these high-impact events where it's affecting thousands of people. San Bruno, California, about 8 years ago, right. $500 million in damage, 8 people died. But, you know, so you have these, you know, low-probability, high-impact events. They do happen. Planes do fall out of the sky.
Wow. All right. Well, Bruce, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it. Thanks for your time, and we'll have you back.
Thanks, Laura.
That's Bruce Gellerman, senior correspondent for WBUR, covering science, technology, and the environment. And Melissa, it was good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
That's Melissa Burchard. She's staff attorney for the Conservation Law Foundation. And Steve Leahy, thank you for coming up from Massachusetts. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Steve Leahy, vice president of policy for the Northeast Gas Association. The Public Utilities Commission of New Hampshire, by the way, just sent notice that they're hosting the 2018 New England Pipeline Safety Representatives Seminar today and tomorrow in Meredith, New Hampshire. So if you want more information on that, check out our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.